Well, first of all, it's very hard to take a rate from a much earlier time,
right,
like the early mid-90s, and then compare it with a rate today, because not only are the methods different that the researchers are using, but the educational and special educational systems are so different that you have people being diagnosed today with something that the same individual would not have been diagnosed with that 20 years ago. So first of all, you're really comparing apples and oranges across time. But then what I would say is that when you look at the rates from 2006 or 2008 to 2010 and so on, those are more comparable because some of the same methods are being used. And what we do see is a really dramatic increase in the number of people that are diagnosed with autism, or what we do call autism spectrum disorders today. And it's very seductive, you know, the idea that you could reduce everything to one or two factors and say there's more autism because of X or Y or Z. But I think the reality is a little less satisfying, and it is that there is a whole host of factors all acting in concert that have produced this different kind of landscape in which more and more people are getting diagnosed with autism. And that includes everything from the way that schools operate to legislation to the broad expansion of the category of autism itself.
Well, let's take a look at your, you know, what you've discovered looking at autism from an anthropological perspective. In your research, what have you discovered about the differences in how autism is perceived by society and the medical community in different countries?
Well, one of the things I found is that there's a remarkable similarity in the way autism looks across cultures. So I could be in KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa, or I could be in New Delhi, or in the Congo, or in New York City, and the features seem so distinct. Some of the physical postures, putting fingers in the ears, repetition, and some of the even the content seems the same. The kinds of things that people are concerned with, Disney characters, Thomas the Tank Engine, and so on, that autistic people latch onto. But having said that, there are also significant differences in how it's experienced, because some societies associate great stigma with autism. There's tremendous discrimination against some people with autism. And there has been in the United States in the past as well, along ethnic and class lines. The other thing that is different is that the way in which a family treats somebody with autism varies, whether you seek one kind of care or another. In South Africa, often people are seeking a form of care that's rather spiritual, and the same in India. And sometimes there are conflicts within families, because you might have the grandparents want their grandchild to go to a traditional healer, and the parents of the child, who maybe have gotten more of an education than the older generation, want to go to a quote-unquote Western-style hospital.
You know, as a parent and someone who has, you know, put so much effort into researching and understanding this, what would you say to a parent of a young child, you know, who just recently had a diagnosis and maybe they just don't know what to do and are feeling overwhelmed?
Well, one of the things that I think that every parent ought to do is to understand that there is not some window of 2 or 3 or 4 years in which your child has to make progress. Because I have a daughter who's 22, and I would say she made her greatest progress at 18 and at 19. We're taught that the brain is most plastic in the early ages when the brain is developing. But that doesn't mean that there isn't tremendous social and intellectual growth much, much later on. And I think that's one of the things I really want to tell parents with young kids. My daughter's continuing to grow and to change, even though she's 22.
Well, Dr. Gringer, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.